Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Well, welcome to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm your host, Douglas Klein. And on Training and Tactics Talk today, we're going to focus in on truck company operations, but without a truck. And that affects a lot of departments across the country. Well, with Training and Tactics Talk, we're very happy to have on board Rick Mosier, a firefighter officer, and he's been in the service for about 14 years, and he's got a lifelong interest and passion for the fire service. He currently serves as a career fire lieutenant for the city of Merriam, Kansas, and he's been there for 13 years. And in this, he rides on an engine, he rides on a truck, and he handles a lot of the training and public education programs for that organization. He's also an avid and a passionate fire instructor, and he works not only as an adjunct faculty for Johnston Community College and the Fire Academy, but he teaches in the curriculum level as an associate instructor for the University of Kansas's Fire and Rescue Training Institute. And one of the areas that he really likes to focus in on is the Fire Officer 1 and 2 courses. Rick has got some good education behind him with an associate's degree in arts and a fire service administration degree, and that was from where he's actually a faculty at, Johnson Community College. He's got a Bachelor of Arts in Management and Human Relations. This guy is involved in the fire service. You talk about being engaged. He's involved in the Fire Education Association of Kansas. He serves them as a member on the Kansas Fire Training Commission. He's active with the FOOLS. He's active with the International Society of Fire Service Instructors, the International Association of Firefighters. He's in, you know, a chapter of the International Fire Photographers Association, doing great works out in the Midwest for the fire service. And it's my pleasure to have on a gentleman that I've met several times and had a great opportunity to sit and share some experiences with when I was out in Kansas and other places that we've been together. So, Rick, welcome on board and welcome to Training and Tactics Talk.
Well, thank you, Chief Klein. I really do appreciate it. It's a great honor to be on your show.
Well, you know, it's a pleasure to have somebody with your passion and desire to take training and education to the next level, and especially to focus in on a topic like what we're going to talk about today. And just imagine, and I'm going to set the tone here, is being, you know, those companies arriving to, and I'm going to make it the first in engine company arriving to a working structure fire, and it's in the typical rural America or in a smaller community or city where they necessarily may not have a ladder company. And this structure fire is a two-story home, and you got this heavy, turbulent black smoke that's pushing out of the house. You've got orange flames that are just leaping out of the first floor window in the rear of the structure. It's about 4 o'clock in the morning. There's cars in the driveway. And the first arriving report, you know, from the officer, he's seen no one outside. And people were, you know, quote-unquote, supposedly trapped. So that kind of sets the tone for us. And as you're thinking about, there's a lot of work that's really got to go into this at this point in time. Engine companies have got a lot of work they've got to get done. If somebody's riding in the capacity of doing rescue work, there's a lot to be done. And, of course, there's a lot to facilitate this from a truck company perspective, or all the functions that have to go into this. Now, I know you've been working on some curriculums for delivery out in the Midwest about truck company operations without a truck. So let's talk a little bit about this, and what's your thoughts at this point, Rick, since we've painted this scenario?
Well, I think you've hit on what can normally be the bread and butter house fire, especially early in the morning time for a lot of fire departments. And this is something that has confronted us in Kansas, because with rural communities and smaller suburbs in some of the metropolitan areas, you know, you don't always have that large truck company or even a city service ladder truck that can respond, and you're dealing with squads or multiple engines or sometimes a rescue vehicle of some type. And, you know, what first comes to mind when you pull up at a building like that, especially with limited manpower and the potential for rescue, I think sometimes you have to think of that inner search, because it can really give you a good, you know, safe haven for the firefighters that are on scene to remain outside the structure. But at the same time, you can aggressively search the sleeping areas in kind of a truck company capacity. And hopefully rapidly find somebody when you don't have enough manpower to attack the fire and search for victims at the same time and ventilate the structure, as we'd like it to happen in the perfect world. So I think that that's something that you really have to think about in the beginning when you arrive with that heavy fire involvement, that type of smoke, and at that early morning hour.
Well, I agree with you here, but let's think about this. Most firefighters, you know, they really enjoy operating that nozzle, and it's almost a passion to go fight fire. Is this what a lot of people think? Well, not necessarily. There's a lot of folks that enjoy all the functions on a fire ground, just like what you just described, and that's a good point. As we move into this, what's your philosophy here about everyone having the basic knowledge and those predicated skills and abilities to perform all operations on a fire scene?
You know, I think that it's vital for everybody in your department to be cross-trained and to be proficient with ground ladders, to be proficient with search, to be proficient working a hose line. And I think you hit on a really important point. I think a lot of fire departments focus totally on the engine company aspect, on the, you know, the wet stuff, on the red stuff, stretching lines, getting in and putting the fire out. And I think sometimes our skills tend to lack a little bit when it comes to ground laddering, when it comes to thinking about search priorities and how to conduct an effective search. When we think about different types of ventilation, you know, whether we want to use a positive pressure or we want to go to a vertical vent, I think sometimes we get kind of tunnel visioned with the ventilation aspect of the fire ground, and sometimes always go towards the PPV when it's not always maybe most applicable for the situation that's at, right in front of us at that time. So I think having a good, you know, a good understanding of those truck company functions, or, you know, you could sometimes call it the fire ground support functions, you know, support functions on the fire ground that assist the engine company in getting the fire put out, but also help to rescue people. I think that that's something that we really have to think about.
Well, I agree. And, you know, we started out talking about this being more of a rural component or in the suburbs where necessarily might not have a true truck running. But, you know, this crosses over a little bit, or a whole lot actually, into larger areas or larger cities that do have truck companies, because it could be that there's a delay in the truck company arriving on scene. Sometimes trucks have a much longer response time than the engine companies or the second or the third due engine companies may have. And it's important that if these functions need to be performed and it's, you know, immediate that these need to be performed, then that proficiency has to fit in there. And I think that that's a good point that you're making. So when we talk about some of these operations, let's start talking a little bit about some apparatus here to kind of set the tone and you know, maybe lead some people down the right path if they're looking at trying to create some of these specialty functions. I know here in High Point, you know, we run, you know, engine companies, we run rescue companies, or squads, and we run ladder companies. And, you know, pretty much they've got some of, you know, the specialty components that they have to do, but also there's a requirement to have proficiency in the skill level. So for, you know, folks that don't have a true truck, or that ladder company, as we'll call it, or a truck company, as we can call it. You know, let's talk about some of the apparatus and some of the thought processes here, and I know you got some ideas on that, so why don't you share?
Sure. You know, I think one of the basic things that you can do, being a community without a truck, is beef up your ground ladders on your engine company. You know, look at the buildings that you have in your first due district or your second due district, and think, you know, standard engine company ladders, a lot of times we deal with a 24-footer, we deal with a 14-foot roof. But you could think on a, you know, more global perspective that maybe we need to have a 28-foot ground ladder on the engine, maybe a 35. Have a couple bigger roof ladders on the engine, maybe have a 16-footer or an 18-footer. Maybe double bank ladder racks is something that we would want to put on an engine company. And it just makes you a little bit more versatile when you get on scene of that fire early morning, late afternoon, early evening, and you need to perform those truck functions. And a lot of times, you know, switching out your ground ladders can be a relatively easy thing and pretty inexpensive. When you really look at it, if you want to take an existing apparatus and kind of beef it up a little bit. And, you know, as far as the other tools, thinking about carrying saws on the engines, circular chainsaws, search rope, rip packs, things like that, that can kind of, you know, beef that engine company up a little bit from just the standard tools that it carries. I think that some of the other types of vehicles that we could think about is some of our rescue trucks. When we go to spec a rescue truck, maybe we include ground ladders in that, and we include some space for some truck company tools inside of the rescue truck. A lot of times they have a perfectly good sliding compartment in the rear where we can get a bank of ladders put in there relatively easily. And sometimes even with smaller, like squad-type apparatus, you can have overhead ladder racks installed on them. And can kind of just beef up your unit a little bit and make it a little bit more versatile without having to have that aerial device on there. Because I think sometimes people, they get into that mindset when you say truck work, they immediately think of the aerial device, and commonly they say, oh, well, the building's going to burn to the ground. And you really have to think more globally, a little bit bigger picture than just the fact that it doesn't have or it does have an aerial device on it of some type. So I think that can really add a lot to your firefighting operation there.
I think this is something that we need to look even a little deeper into from the design aspect. A lot of people that are listeners may be listening, and this is something that needs to go into, if you're speccing an apparatus at this point, is truly understanding the risk analysis that's out there, really doing a comprehensive risk review and looking at the structural anatomy that you have, the sizes and the types of buildings, some of the issues that you're going to run into, and truly designing an apparatus that is going to meet the needs of your community. And that's something that's very, very important. A lot of people spec apparatus, you know, for show. And I know that probably steps on a few toes here, but, you know, let's be honest. A lot of people want that bigger, badder truck than, you know, the department next door. But what we have to be looking at is the versatility that goes with that and the functionality. And functionality is very important when you're talking here. And, I mean, you made a good point. A lot of people don't like to deal with the 35-foot ladders because, oh, man, they're heavy. Well, a 35-foot ladder is truly, if we get into the academy component of this or back to the basics, and in NFPA 1001 we look at ladders, 35-foot ladder is a two-person ladder.
Very true. Yeah, it definitely is a two-person ladder. And I think when you made an important point on that. When you look at that 35-foot ladder, something that I see a lot of departments do is in the specing process of apparatus or with existing units, they have that two-fly, two-section 35-foot ladder that is enormously heavy, and something that I think especially for low manpower situations, you can really use a single fly 35-foot ladder and get a lot more versatility out of it. And I think also it can really make it a two-person ladder to maneuver. And occasionally in a in a really dire need situation, one guy can actually drag a single fly 35-foot ladder up to the building to where another firefighter could assist them to get it raised. And I think that that's something that you really have to think about. You know, like you said, when we look at it, we've got to look at it more than just the gold leaf, the siren, the color of the paint, the raised roof, all the fun trinkety things that we think about when we spec a new rig. And we really have to think, you know, where's this going to be in 20 years? You know, what is the outlook of our community? What's our growth going to be? And what do we need to buy now to really kind of get us through the next few years? So...
Absolutely great points there. And again, you know, this is truck company functions. There's a lot of work that's critical that has to be done to facilitate for interior operations to occur. So let's start out a little bit here and talk some about one of the big functions that we know that truck company operations do. And let's focus in on this forcible entry. One of the big things is to be able to get engine companies and crews inside and for them to be able to function and do the jobs of, you know, either search and rescue, of fire attack, of being able to do, you know, internal ventilation if we're in a bigger building. We've got to be able to get those doors and, you know, accesses open for people to be able to operate. So let's talk a little bit about some forcible entry and how we can make that happen, and we're not riding that true big truck company.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, Chief, is, you know, before you actually can get to the fire, you have to be able to get into the building. And a lot of times, to get into the building, it provides, we have door locks, we have other things that are inhibiting us getting into the building. So we really have to think about, you know, what's our easiest point of access? How can we get in there quickly? And what tools do we carry that make it easy to get into the building, you know, that we can operate in those lower manpower situations?
Important stuff. And, you know, one of the things that comes to my mind is, a lot of times you see in these trade journals or pictures or videos that you may go look at on YouTube, firefighters are coming off the rigs and they don't have any tools in their hands, or they got very minimal amount of equipment. Let's just talk bread and butter here. One of the basic simple tools that if you're going to do forcible entry with is a set of irons. And let's sure. talk a little bit about how well they actually work in some various types of buildings here. We know that we've got metal swinging doors, and we got, you know, the burglar bars over the windows and the doors, and, you know, in some of our residential structures, we've got these large, heavy wooden entry doors that we got to force. If we get into some neighborhoods, they've got the metal door jams, and especially on apartment complexes now, or we get into some commercial settings, we're definitely going to have true metal doors and jams to have to work with. So let's talk a little bit about forcible entry when it comes to the basic tools and what you're up against.
Sure. Yeah, I think you hit on a valid point. You know, the irons are two perfect tools to come off the rig with. And every apparatus should have a good set of irons. You know, a solid one-piece Halligan bar, not a pinned Halligan that could fail under pressure, but a solid forged Halligan bar, a good solid axe. You know, a lot of departments are returning to an 8-pound axe nowadays because it gives you a little bit more bang for your buck when you're trying to force a door or when you're trying to force through an object. And so I think that those are some things that you could think about. And look at the construction of your tools when you go to purchase them. Look at how they're built, how they're forged, how they're cast, and make sure that they're a clean tool as far as that goes to get some longevity out of them. But I think definitely when you arrive on scene coming off with the irons, can be operated relatively with two people in a quick fashion, and that can get you into the front door.
Let's think about some of these things too, and we're loading these rigs, and a little bit of this is you're going to function. It's hard to function without the appropriate tools. So we've identified that a good set of irons or multiple sets of irons would be, you know, imperative be on a truck. But sometimes getting in, it's a little more tougher than just a set of irons. And I know that this is an occurrence that we ran into here real recent in the fact that they had to do a multitude of forcible entry. And with, you know, a couple of, you know, folks, you know, that are working on a scene like this off of a company can wear them out when they've got to do, you know, several of these. So rabbit tools, you know, that's a hydraulic tool that can be used, and it's a one-person tool as well. So what's your thoughts here when we get down to force and entry with tools like that?
You know, actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was going to be my next the next tool that I talked about for forcible entry. You know, I really believe strongly in those hydraulic forcible entry tools, especially tools that are of the type like a Hydroram, where it's a lightweight 6-8 pound forcible entry tool. It's hydraulically operated, and one person can operate it. You know, it just takes one set of hands to tap it in and then pump on the tool, and forces doors very, very fast and rapidly. So when you look at apartment complexes, you look at hotels, you even look at residential front doors, you know, you can get a lot of bang for your buck out of those hydraulic tools with relatively few firefighters. And just having that ready in the jump seat, or having it ready in a tool compartment close to the first guy off the rig, it can make easy work out of a door, and you can rapidly get in. You know, I think another tool that we sometimes don't think about is an officer's tool. When we have a Rex type tool with a large bite on it, kind of takes the place of a K tool, but that can be a multi-purpose forcible entry tool also, to force into some of the doors. And we can also use it as a pry bar, as a small pry bar, and things like that. So I think the hydraulic forcible entry tools, and then also some of the multi-purpose forcible entry tools, really come in handy with these, you know, situations that we're faced today in today's fire service.
You know, you're absolutely right, and those hydraulic tools are not large, and they don't take up a lot of a compartmental space that, you know, it's imperative that, you know, we maximize the efficiency of the room that we have to get, you know, the biggest return, a Six Sigma concept to be exact. Moving along, you know, we're talking about some of these metal doors and some of the issues that you get into. One of them is that in these jams, when they're using these deadbolts, we know that the pinning mechanism that goes in as the deadbolt is extremely long in some of these metal doors. And it's almost impossible to even force the distance to get that free. One of the ways that you can attack that is with a circular saw. And that circular saw being a K-12 with a metal, you know, type blade, and being able to get in, you know, that way is as well. How much of that operation are you seeing, or have you had any success with that type of tool? I know it's very well utilized, especially in the Northeast, and it's really becoming a catch-on item that's going across the United States. What's your experience here?
I think you hit it right on the head. I think it's a very versatile tool, having a K-12, a K-950, or a K-750 saw. I think the things that you have to look at when you use that, because it is such a versatile tool, is you need to check the saw RPM on that when you're going to purchase a saw like that. You want to make sure that you have a high RPM, and I think that some of the circular saw brands out there don't always produce a high enough RPM for the fire service. But it's a very effective tool when you're going to go through locks. And things that you also need to think about with that is the type of blade that you have. Something that my department, we ran into is on our K750 saw, we were using just a standard metal cutting blade that you could buy at Home Depot, $8, $10 blade, and we found out after a couple of uses that it didn't really hold up the fire service use, and so we're currently looking at getting a diamond blade for the K-saw. It'll provide a little bit more longevity. Definitely you'll be able to cut multiple locks, and that's the problem that we ran into, is at a storage unit fire trying to cut multiple locks with that that standard metal blade. It just didn't last for the heavy-duty cutting that we were doing, so we really had to kind of rethink what type of metal blade are we going to carry on that saw. And I think that it's a great tool, one person operation. You have to be proficient with it. You have to train with it. You know, as with any, when you get into these tools, even, you know, with the irons, you have to train with it. You have to be proficient at it. You can look at it and you can talk about it, but you have to really be able to put it into use on the fire ground. And so I definitely think that the K-saws are starting to come back. At least in the Midwest, we've seen a resurgence in using them. And, you know, I think in your company with your engine or a truck or a rescue, you need to think about, you know, how many of those saws do we carry? It doesn't hurt to have a couple of them with different types of blades on them, instead of the old adage of trying to get by with one saw with multiple blades. Think about having a couple saws with different blades on them, and that way you're not having to change it on the fire ground. You can rapidly go and make entry to a building or go to the roof and cut a hole, and you know, it just saves time, you know, and in our business, time is lives, so we have to think about that.
Absolutely, and there's a lot of studies out there that address just regular saws versus fire service saws. And I got into a fairly heated debate at one time in the not too awful, you know, distant past as a chief, as people were trying to truly, I guess, look at the budget and you know, focus in on you know, being frugal with money. They were looking at purchasing regular, like, circular saws that you would go into, you know, Lowe's, or you would go to, you know, Granger or somebody and purchase, and chainsaws versus, you know, the vent saws and the actual K-saws that are in the fire service. And you hit on something. Part of it is the longevity of the tool. How it's not, you know, the commercial saws are not designed to do fire service work, and that was proven. It's like comparing the chainsaw to a vent saw. The blades are drastically different. One of the studies that was done showed that after, you know, two cuts on a roof, you know, two vent holes, that the blade was basically just trashed. It was nothing but wood that they were cutting. 90% of the teeth were pretty much lost or gone, you know, on that chain blade. But if you take a vent saw, they had one that was damaged, and that was it. And that was after they did five times the amount of ventilation holes. And they actually did ventilation holes not only on wood, but two or three on metal. So there's a distinct difference in the quality design for us. So if folks are out there and they're looking at tools for this truck company operation, you know, if you can get by, you know, every once in a while, if you're not doing a whole lot, maybe with some of these lower saws. But, you know, in reality is, it's, you know, you've got to have the appropriate tools to be able to do the job efficiency. And you hit the nail on the head. Time is life, and it's an effect on our life as firefighting operations. It's an effect on our community and the quality of life that these people are going to have, you know, when we're trying to perform search and rescue when we need these tools. So that's good points.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and I think something that you know, something that I wanted to mention a little bit earlier that I kind of revisit is when we think about those hydraulic forcible entry tools, you have to think about how many people is it going to take to operate these. You know, some of those rabbit tools that we talked about, they're a two-person operation, you know, to hold the jaws in the door and then also to pump the tool. And I think, you know, like we just talked about with the circular saws, sometimes those multi-purpose all-cut blades that are advertised are not a multi-purpose all-cut blade. You know, they do really well on metal and concrete, but they're not very good on wood. So you really have to take, when you're going to purchase tools, you have to think and you have to investigate it and you have to try it. I mean, it's, you know, you just have to try it and see if it'll actually do what you want it to do. And if it doesn't, it might mean buying a second saw and equipping it with a really nice 12-tooth or 24-tooth blade to be able to cut wood. And that's something that we found, you know, when we looked at our circular saws, we found the all-cut blade just did not do it for us. And that's why now we carry two 750 saws, 2K saws, and one has the 12-tooth wood blade, and one has the metal disc on it, you know. And now we're equipped and we're ready to go into work, you know, at a moment's notice. So it really does, you know, the time is lives, so.
Well, that's an outstanding point. Tools, you know, when we're looking at all this, you know, tools are important. So if we were making some lists here, let's kind of run back through here. I know we've talked about hydraulic tools as far as, you know, like the rabbit style tools or the door rams. We've talked about irons. We've talked about saws. We can throw you through in, you know, the functionality of an officer's tool like an A tool or a K tool. We've got a lot of tools that can go into, you know, these components. We've thrown in, you know, the search ropes, the writ packs, all these pieces, and, you know, we keep adding when we go back to the ladders of getting the appropriate ladder size. So there's a lot of tools that we know that we've got to function with this. And one place that I really want to go and talk, you know, and focus before our break here is with NFPA standards and ISO standards, it's important that if you're looking to create this functionality in your organization, that you're going to get the biggest bang for the buck. So we talked about apparatus specking, but we need to look at when we equip these trucks that it meets the National Fire Protection Association standards, and we're getting the equipment on there that is appropriate to get maximum points for ISO. And I know that you've, you know, creating this program, this is something I know that you're very aware of and can talk about. So let's jump to that point right now and see what's on your mind here with this.
Well, I think you hit on a really valid point. I think with especially with the communities that we deal with, a lot of the time, you know, having the appropriate ISO rating can really mean attracting new businesses, you know, lower insurance rates. We can really use that as a bargaining chip when our communities and go forward to attract different businesses to our community. And I think the other important point is meeting the NFPA standards. If you build an apparatus that doesn't meet the NFPA standards, even though it's not a law, it's still recognized that if something was to happen, you know, it will be brought up in a court of law because it is a standard. Standard meaning that the vast majority of the fire service abides by it. So I think that that's important. So I think, you know, one thing that I could really recommend to these organizations is when you look at these apparatus, review your ISO rating chart and see what tools am I going to get the most bang for my buck for, and what can I get dual credit for? You know, what qualifies if I put it on the engine? What's going to give me the maximum amount of points?
Well, and to throw in here is as you're going through and you're working towards these maximum points in ISO, it's important that we load our rigs not only for that but for versatility in our operations and how we can function. So good points here. We're about halfway through our show. When we come back, we're going to talk about all the functions that are related to truck company operations, and we're going to dive into some search and rescue and laddering and ventilation and really, you know, get deeper into this and talk some tactical operations and some strategy considerations for our folks and our listeners that are on Training and Tactics Talk. Just a reminder that if you have any questions or comments, please send them in and email them and contact us at Training and Tactics Talk at RadioFirehouse.com. And you're listening to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm your host, Douglas Klein. On board this month is Rick Mosier. We're talking truck company operations without necessarily that large truck. So when we come back, we're going to go tactical.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Well, welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm your host, Douglas Klein. Joining me this month is Lieutenant Rick Mosier from Marion, Kansas Fire Department. And we're talking truck company operations without a truck. And I just am super excited about this topic. I think that it's timely and relevant in the fire service. And basically, these tactics have to be performed on the fire ground for optimum outcomes in our operations. So no matter what type of strategies that we're setting out there on a fire ground, whether it is offensive, whether it's defensive, whether it's transitional, all these components are definitely part of the tactical considerations that we have to have, and it requires people to be functioning in those capacities. And typically these topics we're going to hit next in the second half of the show are truck company functions. And we've talked about equipment on the front end, so let's dive into tactics. I know folks love tactics. I know they enjoy the things that they do. So as we go into this, the first thing we talked about, Rick, was that forcible entry. We've covered some of the tools, and just we hit on it. It's, you know, drastically important that we be able to get companies access to that building that are going to be engaged in fire suppression activities, companies that are going to be engaged in search and rescue operations. It's important. So I set the stage earlier in the show when I talked about arriving, having heavy black turbulent smoke showing from a two-story residential structure. There's fire on the first floor. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, one of the things that we've done, we've got it opened up. We've got a potential for rescue here. Forcible entry was performed in a couple of ways. They've probably got the front door open at this point. But you mentioned that vent inner search component. So if our two-story house is like most two-story residential structures, our bedrooms are probably where? The second floor. So what's that going to require? It's going to require us getting some ladders there, not only for potential access for vent inner search, but also we want to be laddering for life, for secondary means of egress for companies that are working that way. So let's talk about laddering. I know that we discussed the different types of ladders that need to be on some of our apparatus, the consideration of going away from, you know, maybe 24 foot to 35 foot, depending on what you have within your district, changing the sizes, you know, incorporating some specs. But, you know, ladders, how important is laddering in a fire ground operation?
Chief, it's vitally important, and I think I think laddering is one of those kind of lost arts of the fire service for a lot of America, suburban and rural America. It just, you know, in my experience on the fire ground, it's gotten forgotten, and it's vitally important because you hit on some really, really good points. The fact that, you know, not only are we laddering maybe for the fact that we might be doing a vendor search operation searching for life, but we also want a ladder, like you said, to give a secondary means of egress for our firefighters. And I think that is something that gets forgotten a lot of the time. And when you look at the fire as an incident commander and you're outside and you're like, wow, I've got an engine company operating on the second floor now, and there are no ground ladders set up. So if conditions rapidly deteriorate up there and they find a safe haven, how are they going to get down to the ground and out of the building? So I think it's vitally important that we think about those components when we're on the fire ground and practicing with ladders and becoming proficient with them, because it is, you know, laddering is one of those operations that if you are not proficient at it, it will not go smoothly. And injuries can occur very, very quickly if you don't know how to properly ladder a building.
Well, you mentioned that proper laddering. I know that in the academy, when I do ladders, I do this thing called a ladder tour. And you carry every type of ladder you can possibly think about. You'll be carrying them, you know, every way you can possibly carry them. And you're going to be setting them up every possible way you can set up. You're going to climb. And, I mean, this just goes on for forever almost, it seems like, to these recruits. I know it seemed like forever when I went through almost 30 years ago. But there's a couple things to think about here, and we can learn a lot from our Northeastern brothers and sisters in the fire service. That if you pick up a trade journal and you're looking at fire ground operations in the Northeast, you see ladders almost in every window. And to me, that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing at all. And, of course, you know, we do get down. And, you know, if you think about FDNY and they're rolling in, you know, they got tons of folks to be able to do that. And people are going to say, well, we just don't have the people, you know, to do laddering. Well, if you got two people that are focused on, you know, some truck company operations, getting two or three ladders up and they're proficient doesn't take a whole lot of time. The second component to this is, and I want to get your thoughts of what you're doing, but when we start setting these ladders up, we've got to be thinking, are we setting them up for rescue, for entry, or for ventilation operations? That's very critical in the early stages of fires that we get these ladders set very quickly because there's a lot going on and you know the tactical operations in the first you know 15-20 minutes of a fire scene is just you know astronomically moving fast. So what's going on you know in the Midwest here with this and what are some of your thoughts about all this laddering?
Well, I think you hit on some really valid points when you talked about the academy and carrying ladders and setting them up in different ways and fashions. You know, it's vitally important that everybody gets to touch every type of ladder, carry it. Something that we've had great luck in our fire academy with is setting up a ladder confidence course, similar to a confidence course that the Boston Fire Department runs with ground ladders and gets people comfortable on the bigger ladders. And when you arrive on scene, you know, as that first company there, and you start thinking about, all right, well, how do I want to throw my ladders? How do I want to get them to the building? You know, something that we've started to train with in our own organization is getting people to do ladder drags. Get the ladders off the rig, stack your tools into the ladders, and then drag them up to the areas of the house. And you can just set them down, but get them positioned around the building where you think that you're going to need to ladder it. And my rule of thumb is, you know, until you really know what you're going to use a ladder for, I always set it in a lower angle rescue position. It can always be readjusted, but that way, if somebody has to rapidly exit the house, if you have to go up to the window to vent it to make a search, or if you just want to go ahead and get the window vented, in that position, it just gives you a little bit more versatility than putting it at the standard 75-degree angle that tends to be a pretty steep angle for us to work off of. Having it at that lower angle gives us a little bit more, especially if we're descending out of a window onto that ladder, gives us a little bit easier descent than going straight down. So I think those are things that you have to think about. You know, I think it really helps you to have a set plan. You know, really, when you think about the fire ground and you think about ground ladders, you need to have some set plans, and that's part of your whole pre-planning process in your first due district is looking at the buildings, looking at the houses, and thinking, you know, if we had a fire here tonight, how could we get the ladders set up and you know, are they going to be able to fit in the locations that we think we're going to need them? And so I think putting them in the rescue mode is just an easy rule of thumb method that can really help you.
Absolutely. Well, let's transition now because laddering kind of leads us into the next two topics. The first one is ventilation. You know, what are some of the critical considerations that need to be taken, you know, into play here when we're going to perform, you know, ventilation, especially vertical ventilation, or if we're looking at positive pressure ventilation, natural ventilation? What's some of those critical considerations we need to look at?
Well, you know, I think some of the really critical components is, you know, what is our kind of going back to our basic reading smoke, you know, what type of smoke is issuing from the house? You know, what are our smoke conditions? Have we been able to identify where the seat of the fire is? Is there somebody we've been able to talk to? Or in our 360, have we been able to identify where the seat of the fire is? And then also, I think in ventilation, you got to look at your building construction. I think, you know, the most paramount thing is what type of building are we dealing with here? And I think that that's going to give you a good key as to what type of ventilation are we going to use. Because I think really often in a lot of our low manpower situations, we always fall back on the crutch of PPV when sometimes it's not always the best ventilation for the situation that's at hand. And so I really think that you have to look at those three components, you know, fire development, reading the smoke, and building construction to really determine, you know, what type of ventilation do I want to use here at this particular fire.
You know, one of the things I want to throw out is there's a lot of research going on right now in the United States, and, you know, you got the NIST wind study, you know, the wind-driven fire study. There's another piece that's out there, and we're looking at some of these buildings and the way they're designed, and especially some of the dynamics of fire, how it's behaving based upon the products that are inside, that when we're ventilating, we're creating in today's society what is known as ventilation-induced flashovers, where typically we think ventilation is supposed to make it safer, and we're actually doing more harm than good in a sense, because what we're doing is we're creating these flashovers. Whereas if our people are yelling for ventilation, it's hot, you know, we're thinking it's going to give them relief, and all of a sudden we induce this oxygen into this atmosphere and create this flashover. I know that ventintersearch.com had, you know, one of these pieces with positive pressure that, you know, when they cranked it up, it just, you know, flashed over that front room. I've seen it a couple of times in, you know, cases to where, you know, doing vertical ventilation influxed air into that atmosphere, and basically what was occurring is it created the flashover as well. So one of the things I want to say about any time you're doing any type of operation in the fire service here, especially something critical like ventilation, is that we really need to be looking at all the research and data and studying our tactical components. Because if you think about it, and we go back into our textbooks and we look at a lot of what's written there, even though they've been updated and brought to it, a lot of the tactical components and a lot of that information in there is based upon research that is, you know, 30 or 40 years old, and we're beginning to see new research out based on the structural anatomy that we had, especially with these engineered construction designs of these homes, that some of our tactics are not like what we think that they should be. We're seeing, you know, abnormally different effects. So I know that you've looked at this, and I know we've had this conversation in other places. Give me your thoughts here.
You know, I really do agree with you. I think that, you know, it's with the changing in building materials, the fact that fires are burning hotter, they progress more rapidly. You know, I really do think that you're absolutely right in the fact that we have to look, you know, you really have to look at, you know, your tactics for today. And, you know, especially as a fire officer, you have to be on top of those things. You have to really use all the avenues of research that you can. Because I think that the, you know, like with the NIST studies, you know, they have pointed out that fires, it's moving more rapidly than we ever thought that it moved before. And, you know, when we use some of these tried and true tactics, I think that they have to be updated a little bit, you know, and you have to put some new twists on them to get them to work effectively in today's fire environment that we deal with. And I think that one of your, you know, we always have said, you know, like the first hose line on the fire will save more lives than property than rescue alone. And I really do truly believe that as a fire officer. I think that, you know, a well-positioned hose line is definitely going to allow us to save more lives than property. But, you know, with that well-positioned hose line, you know, we have to think about that ventilation component and, you know, what type of smoke are we dealing with, what type of building construction, and depending on the type of ventilation that we choose, you know, how is it going to enhance the fire? You know, what point of the building are we looking to ventilate at? And is it going to draw the fire back onto the engine company? Is it going to draw it into areas where, you know, potential lives are, and how is it going to kind of affect that aspect?
Now, those are important pieces of the puzzle that we've definitely got to look at. And another thing to throw in here, we were talking a little bit about positive pressure ventilation, but we also have to recognize that the size of the structures and, you know, how effective positive pressure is going to be. I know that with our fans, you know, we're looking at the amount of cubic feet per minute that they put out. And typically you'll see people grab one positive pressure fan and put it in the front door or in a door and try to ventilate a structure. But some of the residential structures that we're seeing, and, you know, if we go back into the old farm-style houses, you know, we're talking 4,000, 5,000 square foot house, and, you know, putting, you know, the typical one fan in the door is not going to move that much air in a significant amount of speed, especially if we're using positive pressure as an attack tool. So we have to think about going back with the ability to stack fans and you know, utilizing multiple fans at, you know, the point of entry, those type of things. How much of that are we missing the boat on some of this stuff? What's happening that you're, you know, engaged in and seeing out there as you're teaching some of these classes and you know, the mentality of students as they come through?
Well, you know, actually, I think we're in it's kind of an interesting age that we're in right now. I think that there is a lot of people where their eyes are being opened to how they perform positive pressure ventilation. I'm seeing it more now than I've ever seen it before, and the fact that, you know, in the past, it really was, like you described it, was we pull up, we stretch a line, we throw the fan at the front door, we go look for an exit point, we open up a slider door, we bust out a window, we find an exit point, and that's just the firefighting that we were doing for a long time. But I think now, I think people are looking at it more on a, you know, I would kind of say on a scientific perspective, in the fact that when we look at these buildings, you know, when we're dealing with some of these houses, when we deal with some of the big box stores that we find in these smaller communities, we really have to think about, you know, stacking the fans, getting them set up to provide the airflow to move the smoke. And I think that that's something that we're really starting to pay more attention to, and understanding, you know, after a few alarms and going, man, we really didn't move the smoke that we needed to move, and we didn't provide the ventilation relief. You know, I think that the other thing, too, is providing some type of, you know, maybe before we start the fan, we start with some type of horizontal ventilation and see if the current air currents that we have are moving the smoke out of the house for us. And then maybe assisting it with stacking fans or using one fan at the front door. I think one of the things that we've looked at is when we've been buying our fans is, you know, how much airflow is the fan actually putting out? Instead of just buying a standard PPV fan, we actually are looking at, you know, what kind of horsepower does it have? What kind of CFM is it pushing? And when we think of some of the bigger stores that we have in our city, you know, we definitely are looking towards getting a little bit beefier fan, you know, thinking that, man, if we need to ventilate the grocery store, we need to ventilate the Home Depot, you know, how are we going to get that accomplished? And then what does the building offer us as far as ventilation points to assist us with that? So, I think that that's something that's on the forefront of the fire service. I think that people are starting to really look at that and taking a little bit more in-depth look at PPV and how we can use it as an effective tool on the fire ground instead of just kind of going at it as we've always done.
And ventilation is a twofold component here. One is that it does make a safer environment for us to work in, and it also is conducive for victims. If they are viable, the quicker we can get the conditions changed and stabilized with clean airflow where they're most likely going to be, their chance of survivability is drastically higher. So moving in that capacity, we've talked about laddering, we've talked about the forcible entry to get us into the building, the ventilation to create the environments that are conducive for our operations internal to the building, based upon, you know, the conditions of the structure and the fire as it progresses. But our number one focus, and why we're doing a lot of these, is to get in for search and rescue. And that's a big piece. And again, if you look tactical or strategy considerations, you know, your biggest priority is life safety for your folks, but also in search and rescue for viable victims. So Let's talk about search and rescue and what's really going on with search and rescue now. I know that when we think about it, there's controversy in organizations, no matter where you go, of searching, you know, in front of the hose lines or without a hose line or above, you know, the fire area. There's always controversy there. You've got to, you know, take those calculated risks, and I think that's something that we really need to have is a true risk-benefit analysis in our operations if we're going to be without hose lines and operate maybe only with a search rope or based upon, you know, knowing the structure. So search and rescue, what's your thoughts here?
You know, I think that I think when you think of search and rescue, like with all your fire ground functions, you have to think, you know, that in that risk-benefit analysis, what as an organization or as a company, what are we capable of? You know, what is our extent of our training? And, you know, I think that that's going to steer you in the direction, in the right direction. You know, if you're proficiently trained and if you do train to use search ropes to search above the fire and that's an approved policy for your organization and you feel proficient at it, I think that that's a viable option for you. I think that I think definitely for a lot of organizations, it's not always something that they're super proficient at. And I think when that occurs, you know, you really have to look at it from the risk-benefit analysis of is that, okay, well, maybe we need to either get a line on the fire and then start our search behind the hose line. I've never been a super big fan of searching in a structure with a charged hose line just because I feel that to a certain degree it slows you down. It really can slow you down. But if that's your level of comfort and your risk-benefit analysis says that I know my training level says that I need to search with a line, then you need to search with a line. Because search and rescue is one of those things that you can really get into a jam very quickly if you exceed your level of training. You can get into a bad situation quick because remember, folks, when we're dealing with search and rescue, we are in a building that is on fire. There is live fire in the building, and we really have to be proficient at that. I think things that we also have to look at is when we go into these buildings, we got to look at the type of building we're dealing with. You know, when we go into a house, is it on a slab foundation? You know, does it have a basement under it? In some of our suburban rural communities, we have these big box stores that we go into. And I think a lot of times, you know, communities look at that, fire departments look at it, and they go in with the residential search tactics. And you really have to think about large area search in those buildings. You know, am I trained in large area search? Do I know how to effectively conduct that large area search? Because, folks, if you go into a large building and you use residential search practices, you are setting yourself up for failure. You're setting yourself up for a line of duty death. So you really need to be conscious of that. You know, that's one of those, like ground ladders, you know, search procedures are one of the top things that we have to really be proficient at in order to make it safe for ourselves.
You hit on something, and I'm going to give you an amen from the back row of the Baptist here. We can't utilize residential tactics on commercial structures. And that's something that we've seen that has failed us repeatedly in the past. And in some of the reports and, you know, looking back at where we've had, you know, significant injuries or line-of-duty deaths, those components have come out as, you know, some of the issues or problems that existed. And the thing that folks need to realize about search and rescue is this is a very timely event. There's a very short period or a very narrow window when victims are viable. With today's products, the way that they're burning and the byproducts that are produced through the combustion process, we're dealing with, you know, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide levels being through the roof. I mean, some of these situations you get in one breath, your carbon monoxide levels are so high that, I mean, it's instant death. We're also looking at that we got hydrogen sulfides, we've got phosgene gases that are out there. There is just, you know, the cyanides that are in there. I mean, we're actually even monitoring, you know, hydrogen cyanide now before we take our air packs off, along with CO, to make sure that we're in, you know, a safe environment, to, you know, to operate when we, you know, are late into the game and overhaul. But, you know, all these components, you know, doesn't leave a huge window, a survivability for a lot of our victims, especially if your response times are, you know, 8, 10, 12, 14 minutes onto a scene, you know, how long has that house been burning? How long have they been in there? You know, how much is, you know, how much smoke and how much damage is done long before you even get alerted? So that's something we have to take into consideration. And times have changed. I know that in a program I do called Searching in the Modern Environment, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we can have people sleeping. At 3 o'clock in the morning, we can have people that are awake, and you know, or maybe they fell asleep at the computer, you know, in the office. So it's not the typical, you know, what I grew up with, you know, 20 to 30 years ago, that, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, you automatically went to the bedrooms. We can't just necessarily take that into consideration. I think it's still a predominant factor, and that's probably one of the best places to start. But we have to realize that lifestyles and the way people are functioning and operating today are different. And, of course, we're building, you know, bigger and bigger homes for residential structures. We're talking about, you know, all these suburbia places, you know, popping up with mass areas that definitely have a lot of people that are going in and out of. So we got to look at that. The last thing I really want to hit is that if we're going to control the incident, we've got to mitigate a lot of the hazards. And, you know, part of the truck company functions, part of initial size-up functions can be controlling utilities. You know, that's important. But for us to function, another piece that I think about is having a safe fire ground, and that's getting lights up, not only external but internal, being able to provide the optimum, you know, atmosphere to be able to function and work. So jump in here, Rick, and give me some of your thoughts on these final topics.
Yeah, you know, I think that I think you're talking about a really, really important point. You know, you think back to the fire apparatus that of yesteryear, you know, and we had small little 12-volt lights on them, maybe had a box light to take inside, and scene lighting really wasn't a thought, you know. I mean, we just didn't put a lot of emphasis on that. I think in today's firefighting environment, you know, when we spec our apparatus and we think about that, there's some great options out there with LEDs now. And some of these LED lights that you can put around the fire apparatus can really turn in, you know, on an engine company without having to have a generator. You can turn nighttime into day. And you have to, for firefighter safety, you have to light the exterior of the building up, not only for trip hazards in the yard, but, you know, just so that we can have a good picture of what we're dealing with here. So I think that, you know, apparatus lighting is a big component of that. I think when we think about, you know, as far as, we haven't talked a whole lot about aerial type devices, but if we have an aerial type device, you know, thinking about lights on the tip of the aerial. So if we put it up in the air, maybe we're not using it as an elevated master stream, but we can definitely use it as a light tower. And some of the other things too is there's a lot of vehicle mounted light towers nowadays that are relatively inexpensive that can mount to the apparatus and provide us with some great scene lighting. You know, and one of the important things that I picked this up from Fire Commissioner Leo Stapleton from Boston is always having a hand light on. You know, that was something that Boston really took on in the 90s as far as getting everybody with a hand light on them. And I think that that's important. I think every firefighter should come off the apparatus with some type of light on them, whether it's a box light, a coat-mounted light. And in my own personal opinion, you know, you should have a couple different lights on you. You never know when the batteries are going to go out. You know, they always go out at the most inconvenient time. But I think that's important, you know, and I think also, you know, proper illumination of our entry and exit points out of the building. You know, I think that that really can assist us in the fact that if we're inside doing searches or we're inside attacking the fire, if we illuminate our exit points, it can really help us to exit the building in a safe fashion. And also, if we have to make a rapid exit, sometimes by illuminating the exits, it can be a good identifier for us inside the building. Something that I wanted to touch on that I forgot to mention earlier is, you know, especially when you're in that building and you're doing that search, folks, remember to always, if you don't have that hose line with you, always have a search rope attached to yourself. And that way it can, you know, help you to rapidly exit the building. But I think definitely, you know, having lighting on the exterior, having some lighting on the interior is a vital point for having a safe fire ground operation.
Well, that's some great additional tips to go in to kind of wrap us down. You know, for our folks, you know, we're talking about truck company operations, and you don't necessarily have to have a 100-foot aerial platform that's 73.5 foot long and you know, who knows how many pounds, you know, of an apparatus. You can do truck company operations off of engines. And it's a function, and that's part of what we've got to look at is it's a tactical function that has to occur, and it's part of what needs to occur on each fire ground. Any final closing thoughts or comments that you have, Rick?
You know, I think that I think with everything that we've talked about today, you know, each component here takes training, and you really have to know what your limitations are for your fire department, for your particular fire company. You have to know what are we, you know, what are we proficient at, what are we not proficient at. You need to take that non-proficiency list and become proficient at it. Until you become proficient at it, you need to know what situations you can operate in and be effective. You know, like we talked about earlier with that, you know, those 12 to 14 minute response times, we have to look at the rest of the profile when we arrive on scene. We have to, that's vital, because that, you know, is going to tell us, is somebody, do we really think that somebody's viable in there, or is this just a situation of we're going to take a little bit of a step back, we're going to move a little bit slower, we're going to be a little bit more methodical in our fire attack methods and keep it a lot safer for us? Because, you know, remember, folks, if you are not safe, then nobody else is safe. You know, as the emergency responders, we're the helpers. We've got to keep ourselves safe in order to be able to help the people that we're being called to help. So, you know, I think that those are all things. I think good situational awareness, solid training, and knowing what you need to train on. I think those are important aspects to this whole truck company operation.
Well, I think you've hit all the good points right there on the head, and of course, I'm the first one that believes that training is just critical and that we need to stay very focused on our training, and every day should be a training day. And you don't train until you get it right. You train until you can't get it wrong, and that's a philosophy we need to have. Well, Lieutenant Rick Mosier from the Merriam, Kansas Fire Department has been our guest. Rick, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this topic. I know you're very passionate about it. I know that you're delivering programs out in the Midwest with this, and we need to keep the focus going, because a true safe tactical fire ground is going to produce optimum results, and that's what we're after. For our listeners, again, if you have any comments or topics you'd like to hear, just email us at radio@firehouse.com. And you've been listening to Training and Tactics Talk. You know, we focus our show on training for the firefighters in the streets, you know, taking it to the streets where our folks, you know, get the best information, the best knowledge, and try to make our fire grounds and our fire responses a lot more safety so that everyone does go home. Final plug, just remember out there, folks, safety starts with you, and that starts with training and having safe tactics. And the first thing, you got to get there safely. So buckle up. Make sure you wear those seat belts. I'm your host, Douglas Klein. Thank you for tuning in. Rick, again, thank you for being on the show. And we look forward to having our listeners back with us next month for another exciting topic. Till then, stay safe and train hard.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.